You're listening to Triple Radio on the Fat Gatsby Network.
Stream is up, engaged. Podcast is rolling. Podcast is recording.
I'm going to do this.
Weiss is bracing for impact.
Yeah, I know. We're about the Star Trek shake.
Weiss, Tim is doing something really funny. He's moving around. It's
I bet.
Yeah, I did the bit
all over the place.
I did the Star Trek bit.
He's so goofy. Yeah. He's a goofy guy.
Mm-hmm. All right. You said you're recording, right?
Oh, yeah, I am.
All right. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Triple Radio. This is Tim. That's Dave. That's Weiss.
Hello.
I'm still playing with your levels a little bit, Tim.
Okay.
Tim's. Yeah.
We're still just got going. We're just underway here. Yeah, Weiss can't see me.
Tim could be doing literally anything.
I'll be pulling visual tricks on Weiss the entire episode.
Yes. Not visual trickery.
I might be saying one thing, but doing something different with my hands. But Dave can see me, so he can see you. But he may or may not choose to communicate these things
to
Weiss.
Get your bare toes off of the stream. This is not that kind of show.
It is now. I need to get them bitties.
Oh boy, gotta get them.
We must get the bitties.
Yeah, my youngest. Went to the store. I took her to the store with a friend today, and they bought sweatshirts with a designed by a particular influencer. This is just part of my life that I have to go to Target and get sweatshirts designed by an influencer. And on the back of the sweatshirt said "Third Time's the Charm." And so I asked the friend, why does it say "third time the charm"? And she says, well, you know how sometimes you try something one time and it doesn't work out and you try something the second time? I said, I'm going to stop you right there. I understand what the phrase means. I want to know why it's on the back of the sweatshirt. And she said, well, it's because the influencer who made the sweatshirt, her channel got banned one time and then it got banned again. And now the third time her channel is open. And I'm like, why are you this? She seems like a bad influence on children. Why?
Bad influencer. Someone
you should be paying attention to. Why is this someone that gets to have a line at Target? And she says, oh, it's not her fault. They banned her account because they said she was dressing inappropriately for someone under 16. But she was just wearing a halter top and it was just up to here. And like, I can't explain to my 9-year old, like that's explaining to my 9-year old's friend. That like they banned her from her
younger
safety,
daughter's
sweetheart.
Friend. Yes,
they're banning her so that old pervy men don't gawk at her, and her parents are complicit in this. And now she gets a line at Target because the world is disgusting. Oh, the world is disgusting in so many ways. Microsoft, how about that for a transition? Wow.
All right. Yeah. Sure. Let's go. All right. I'll ride that
Let's
wave.
Let's get right into it. 3,200 people, according to Jason Schreier.
I saw that number. Mm-hmm. That is as far as I went.
This has been building. Yeah, it's been a busy, sort of a busy month in game news. But we held off recording until today because
we had a feeling. Yeah,
Jason Schreier literally multiple times I saw him saying like, we'll know what's going to happen on July 6th, like after the 4th of July holiday, after the Microsoft fiscal year ends, like what is going to happen? Because right after Summer Games Fest and the Xbox Showcase and all that stuff a couple weeks ago, like a week later, there was like rumors flying around of like Xbox is going to be shutting down these studios. Like some of these studios that they've purchased, some that had just announced games, and it was like, what the fuck is going on? And now we know what's going on, Xbox has this new CEO. Xbox is not profitable enough in the eyes of Microsoft. So many studios were purchased. So Microsoft bought so much shit in the last 10 years.
Oh my gosh.
So many companies. Some of which they already have like shut down, like the company that made like Hi-Fi Rush, or they sold them off or some crap like that. Yeah. These games would go out on Game Pass, and then they'd be like, oh, your game didn't sell well enough. It didn't make enough money. And it's like, well, you put it out there for on the service that people pay for, where they're not going to buy the game. They're just going to play it. What's going on? Ultimately, that led to today when ton of layoffs, and this was after they had like a bunch of layoffs last year too, but 3,600 more layoffs. Fortunately, no studios are being closed as a part of this.
I saw Double Fine went indie. Yes, that was the
Double Fine
one
is once again an independent studio,
yep.
Which is fine. Hint, Compulsion is independent.
Fine. Yeah.
Ninja Theory and Undead Labs are being sold. And Arcane in which is, you know, owned by ZeniMax or Bethesda or something like that. They are they are now in consultation because that studio is based in France. So they have these things called labor laws over there where these things have to be discussed. Yeah. So, yeah, a few studios breaking off from Microsoft. It was not all of those people were laid off today. Some of them are still coming, like Blizzard. They still have to figure out figure some things out before they know who's going to be. More people are going to be laid off like the whole year in the next 12 months that don't know it yet. So,
and these aren't even the studios that were necessarily being bandied about over this past week as contenders. I think people were... definitely a lot of talk about Bungie and Bungie's future lately. So I thought
Microsoft doesn't own them. No.
So I'm thinking of something else.
They're in cahoots with Sony. Bungie, I don't know if they're owned by, no. Bungie, wait, Destiny 2. Yes. Okay. Yeah, I'm thinking Destiny of the right 2. Company. Yeah, well, they announced that they're shutting down Destiny 2.
Yes.
And they called it like a failure or something like that. which maybe, or it just never hit the expectations that they wanted it to. Mm-hmm. It's fine. Yeah, that's some different.
I was under the impression that quite a lot of people played Destiny 2. But okay.
That's not enough, Dave.
That's not enough. No,
they are a subsidiary of Sony. Okay, I wasn't wrong there. Yeah.
Yes. Ninja Theory is a curious one. In that they were they partnered exclusively with Sony for many, many years. And now what if they went back? I don't know. I don't see Sony swooping in and being their white knight, certainly.
Well, it was just Heavenly Sword, I think.
Was it just Heavenly Sword?
Yeah. Because then they made Enslaved, which was on everything. Then they made DMC, which was on everything.
I thought there was something else besides Heavenly Sword.
Maybe there was before that, but it was a long time ago. But that was just...
Tune in this week for Dave getting his facts wrong.
All kinds of facts. Sony is just like all mixed up in his head, what they own, what they don't own.
Jeez.
Ninja Theory for me, it's like I really like Ninja Theory and have for quite a long time, and I enjoy the Senua games, and they announced a new one, and it's like, oh, that's awesome. And then there was talk like, oh, yeah, they might be shutting down Ninja Theory. It's like, wait, what?
the guys that won all those BAFTAs?
Yeah, but it was also, you know, you just announced their new game last week, last month, but apparently that was just maybe a play to get more money for the sale, grease the wheels a little bit, like, oh, look what's coming, look how people are excited for this game. And Undead Labs, like, yeah, State of Decay 3, I don't know if that was just announced or more announced. I don't really pay attention to the State of Decay series, but still, I know people care and love about that, but it's just big changes for Microsoft after they spent years under Phil Spencer, like just buying tons of studios and now trying to justify the $63 billion they spent to buy Activision Blizzard, which seems insane, like an insane thing to try to like make a profit off of as it is. But things changing big time over at Xbox for sure. And
It's so funny. So I was running sound on a shoot a couple of weeks ago, And I met a guy who I had not worked with before. Lovely guy. Someone, you know, said that, oh, hey, you guys are both gamers. You'll get along. And we did, certainly. But he confessed to being, he said, oh, I'm an unabashed Xbox fanboy. But the curious thing that he said is that how excited he was for Xbox's new CEO. And he goes, oh, she's kicking ass and taking names. She's really going to turn things around. She's not putting up with any funny business. I'm like, dude, you don't know what the fuck you're talking about.
Did you pull this man off of a forum 10 years ago?
What? I know, right?
No, it was the weirdest thing. Like, she is, you know, obviously content to be the person to fall on the sword. She was given this promotion to be hated, to absorb a lot of negative press. That's I guess that's the Faustian bargain I think you get sometimes. Like, yeah, I'll take the promotion. Oh, it's over the worst possible time. Well, it's a promotion. Yeah, I don't mind being hated because I'm not a gamer and don't care about the games business.
Well, it's like you get to be a CEO of something and get that on your resume. And
she came from their AI division, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's, I don't know. It's just like,
so there's that.
Everything, you know, for me, and I do have that old Xbox over there, and do have Game Pass, though I have that grandfathered in, like, cheap version of good Game Pass. And even like after this news started popping up, I'm just like, do I still need that? It's like, but then I'm like, why do I have an Xbox then? Well, it's like, I guess so I can still play my legacy Xbox stuff that I have on there.
Yeah.
Because everything works going back to the 360 just about. And then I still have a 360 in the house, so that's fine. But I'm just kind of like, I don't know. We'll see still lots of stuff coming to it, but I'm just kind of like, what made it attractive was like, oh, I'll get Double Fine games and Ninja Theory games and this stuff. And now it's like, okay, well, what now? I guess we'll see where it goes or what. But I mean, as a platform, since the Xbox 360, it has not been the most exciting, at all. It's just kind of like, I don't know, they just floundered after the 360. I feel like,
I mean, it was the Game Pass machine. That's the reputation now. Yeah,
but it's just like after 360, it was kind of like, well, Halo died down, Gears died down. It felt like a lot of the series that carried the 360 kind of fell off. You know, Assassin's Creed was falling off. Mass Effect completed its trilogy. You know, BioShock, these retro games I'm naming, and just kind of like, you know, the Xbox One was that, well, weird, oddly enough, from the start, they were like, oh, they had the whole weird thing with digital ownership, and not being able to like trade games around or like linking them to your account. And it's going to be like this all in one box for your living room. And everyone just hated that messaging. Sony ate their lunch by being like, hey, you know, you can just borrow games just by handing this physical game to your friend. And our console is going to be way cheaper.
Easiest transition of all time. Like, we're both waiting here to.
In the race to the bottom, here's Sony on the other side now announcing that they are just no longer will be producing physical media for their future consoles. Is that that's
so
the thing?
They will not be providing discs for new software after this is like January of 2028. So if you've already like printed games for PlayStation before then, you can like order more.
Okay.
I guess there can be more copies of Final Fantasy 16 or whatever printed for PlayStation after this date, but there will not be newly printed physical PlayStation games from, I don't know what that means for limited run games. I assume they'll still be able to get a hold of discs and do something.
I mean, one might assume that, but I've also read that in a broader business sense, this is part of an ongoing effort on the part of Sony to wind down Blu-ray production across all categories. So
yeah, as far as I know, this is like Sony anti-physical media across the board, kind of more on the future than the you'll get the games for this year and next year. Yeah. But like, it's just kind of the fight for physical media and the stupid cycle that will be when it, you know, because now they're going to be record stores. Now it's I don't know, like it's just turning into that with every pastime right now. I don't know. It's a bummer. I want physical media for everything.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, I realize and understand that like a PlayStation 5 game that you purchase, you do not put it into the console and then it plays game. You know, it copies over at best, it copies over to the hard drive and then you can play it. But you know, most of the time it's just kind of prompting a download, to, you know, come down from the internet, you know, in a lot of cases, like that is a physical, you know, game key more or less, but still it's a physical game key that I can sell, or let somebody else borrow or something like that in or purchase on sale on clearance. Which that's what it hurts more than anything. It's just kind of having it as a consumer choice, but you know, I get that it's not something you just pop in your system and play. Like, it's not a real game, kind of. Like,
yeah, which is frustrating to start with. I mean, it still should.
I know, like, limited run stuff that they press that are of indie games, like, those are generally on the disc. And those just copy over. But, yes.
I mean, in general, the ownership versus leasing your media fight.
Yeah, but it's like if you go into Target, if you're in a Target and you go into their game section, like they don't have physical Xbox games, at least at the Targets around me. They have not had physical Xbox games for like a couple years now. They have the hardware. They'll have like some digital codes, but they don't have like a Xbox game section. The PlayStation game section is usually very small and they have a good amount of Nintendo games.
Yeah.
Which makes sense, but you know, Nintendo gets like a whole aisle, and then the other stuff is kind of mishmashed over here, more or less.
I personally am someone who has been nearly virtually all in on digital distribution for the better part of a decade now. I am someone who, you know, for me, everything about it is more convenient. I dare say I actually prefer it, but the there is an astounding amount of cognitive dissonance in A, announcing you're discontinuing physical media, and then at the same time announcing that you are actively revoking the license to purchases to more than 200 films that users have purchased digitally.
Yep.
That is particularly galling to me as someone who wants to embrace an all-digital future, is the idea that even what is called a purchase really isn't, if that license can be taken away and you don't get to be in ownership of those bits and bytes stored locally on your playback device.
Which you never did, and like it just being in the people, you know, like the public's face again, to be like, you do not own these things. You are renting these games and movies. That's it.
Without any attempt at recompense.
And
that's without any attempt at smoothing it over or glossing it over. This is kind of the most really, like, you know, I feel like in the past at an inconvenience like this, Sony would at least feel compelled to say, like, you know, listen, you know, Sony would offer a mea culpa of some kind. They would say, listen, our hands are tied. We don't own these properties. Their licensors revoked the licenses. Believe me, we would want you to be able to keep them in perpetuity, but we can't. We're not allowed. And as trouble for your inconvenience, here's a $10 coupon for a digital download. You know, like,
at the very least,
I'm accustomed to some kind of weak mea culpa. And they're not even attempting that at this point.
No, they don't have to, because
fuck you.
Because, you know, Xbox has fallen so far off. They're not like a straight, they're not a competitor and Switch, you know, Nintendo's just over there doing their own thing and kind of not really, doesn't really factor into the plans of Sony or Microsoft when it comes to this stuff. But also at the same time, Sony was like, yeah, we're shutting down the PS3 and Vita store. So it's just like,
fine.
Yeah, sure. Well, but it's like, it's another place you can't buy non-physical games.
Yeah.
So it's just like, you know, you look at this, it's like, okay, well, we don't have physical games. We're not going to have physical games after this point. So it's like, well, why do you buy stuff? What does that say for buying something on the PlayStation Store after 2028 when in 2030 something, 2040, well, we have to shut down the old PlayStation Store?
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
And that goes away. What does that mean for that? And this is why people pirate stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Literally. I mean, that was the literal next sentence. It's just sort of like people are so sour on, I mean, like even, you know, who buys day one purchases unless it's very, very rare at the moment and so forth. It's just pushing people further and further into the pirate zone.
Mm-hmm.
And well, for game preservation and all that makes that super hard too. I don't know. It's frustrating.
I've been very interesting to see Frank Cifaldi weigh in on this kind of thing and what it actually means for people like him. And what I do find compelling is just trying to take a very long view of the history of media ownership and how digital media ownership specifically has made it possible for any one private individual to own vaster libraries than nearly any single individual in history prior to this day and age. And I say own, even if that ownership is temporary possession, you know, any single person has access to a far greater media library of works of creative works, you know, than ever before. So what does it really mean that we don't own these things? If throughout most of human history, we were never able to own a copy of a piece of artwork and hang it on a shelf and say, this is mine to appreciate, you know, the ability for middle-class people to purchase art at all is a fairly recent phenomenon, only goes back maybe 300-400 years. So, you know, what are we, I am angry. I'm upset, but I'm also trying to really sort of like take stock as I look at my, as I look at the 3000 games in my Steam library that I will never play in the time of my lifespan and think like, I own these things, but also why?
I mean, it's fair to be grateful for the wealth as well as angry at the, I mean, I don't know. It is nice that for a time games were something that everyone across budgets could afford. And like, I think like even that with like the system costs, because I'm like more and more seeing games as going to be elitist, like the Steam box and like all the console hikes. I just always think of like
everybody. That's right. Yeah, Xbox had another price hike.
Yep.
Since we last talked.
Is that
too? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just keep thinking about like every school knew that one person with a Neo Geo, and now like that's every console.
Yeah, what this says for the future of the existence of consoles at large.
Yeah.
Is, you know, just doesn't really make them make sense anymore. And then you hear news about like, guys, all this stuff has always been niche. You know the numbers that Roblox does. Like that's what the kids are playing on the devices that they already own, you know, that do not need boutique hardware to play these games. It is wild for me to think, you know, I'm glad that I'm an enthusiast and that I've been able to expose my kids to the video games that I consider like important, worthwhile creative works, as opposed to the ones that are just disposable entertainment. And I also have to reconcile with the fact that, like, I'm a working artist, and so I have a different view of media than most people. Like, it does hurt my heart a little bit to know that what I consider significant, important creative works to most people are just, yeah, it was fun. It's disposable entertainment, and they don't think about it too far beyond that. And that's, you know, is that just the heartbreak that every media enthusiast, is that the heartbreak of the music enthusiast who peruses record stores and probably owned at one point a large record collection, you know, before everything went digital, and had access to their favorite music and were able to share their favorite music with their children in ways that most other people just didn't care about. I don't know. It's big, depressing. It's nothing but depressing questions with this news.
Oh, I know. Well, because it goes, you know, like that goes into, you know, like the shift into from like art to content to like, and like how much. Yeah, because that goes right into AI and blah, blah, blah. So it's just sort of like our societal view of the worth of art.
Yeah.
You know, tiny little topics.
I do wonder, art's good. In most other forms of media, there are sort of categories that are sort of the creative leaders, and they're not really expected to be profitable in and of themselves. But because they'll often have a financial long tail of some kind, you know, with movies, it is that you spend a whole bunch of money on a blockbuster movie for it to play in a cinema, not you know, not on a bespoke machine that people need to purchase and own, but for a wide swath of people to get to experience in a more public facing way. You know, radio hits drive ads and thus drive album sales. Broadway hits rarely are profitable, but they drive the regional market, and they are kind of the creative engine. That's where the creatives make their thing. And so I feel like, and even, you know, a generation ago, that was arcades, right? You know, arcades was a very low financial cost of entry to the end user, because it was expected to just sort of be a one-time experience, and there was no like ownership exchange. You know, the arcades was where the big ideas happened, and then that seeded creativity out into other parts of the industry that were maybe not. So I feel like there will always be a place for the people that are pushing the creative medium of games forward. Where are they going to be, and who's going to spend money on that? Like, what entity is going to subsidize that? You know, there's some big corporation is going to say, yes, I'm willing to put up big money to make a big video game. But what does that look like in the future? That's what I think I'm reckoning with. Is that something that is that where cloud gaming is gonna happen? You know, the latency is not too bad now. A lot of people are doing it. Is cloud gaming on big expensive servers that you pay maybe a la carte fees for? Is that where the big games are gonna happen? And then the people that become enthusiasts, are we gonna run smaller, more indie games on our less powerful machines? I don't know. I'm trying to imagine ways in which there's still this sort of big budget, like creatively leading the industry, that everyone else sort of takes inspiration from.
Yeah. That's what I most wonder. I mean, wonder about is what is the longevity of like triple A games at this point? Cause they take so long to make, and they always go over budget. Like, you know, GTA 5 came out like 13, 14 years ago, and GTA 6, I mean, they made Red Dead Redemption 2 in the middle, but yeah, GTA 6 is coming out this year probably, and they, you know, they released 3 GTAs on PS2, and it's like, you know, who knows when we're gonna get another Final Fantasy game. And it used to be, you know, you'd get 3 on a console life. But yeah, just the amount of production that gets put into those games,
it
makes them take longer, and they're less risky. So yeah, I don't
they're less interesting. Yeah. And lack of monoculture always changes everything too.
Tim, explain less risky. What are they? What are you saying? AAA games?
So less risky with gameplay. You know, with what they do with the game. That's what I mean.
Okay.
Yeah, less experimental. Yeah. It's like, no, we're going to make something that people like, or we think that people will like, and we're going to stick to that.
Like the state of blockbuster action movies, say.
Yeah.
It's safety.
Yeah, you're not going to see like a big swing with it, because it has to do well to make up that money, you know?
Yeah, like Marvel's not taking
creative
risks. Creative risks, yeah. I know, but I mean, it's like any art. Like, someone needs to come out with something that we didn't know we wanted, but we did, and be able to, like, take that risk on the back end. Like, Clair Obscur, coming out of nowhere.
Yeah.
You know? But I guess on a whatever the future of consoles is, you know? Or if that's even the word we use in the future, I don't know, but...
Yeah, well, it's just going to be, you know, independent stuff
maybe there's more splintered, you know, groups of, you know, like play dates for like hardcore enthusiasts, something for like general audiences that's like a small in like interesting to the masses kind of like cheaper device,
and that's
because like no one can afford it.
Well, so that's here's the other thing that drives me nuts. Is that, you know, I think we all love our portable consoles, us diehard gamers, and there's never been a time in technology manufacturing that is more, I think, driven toward portable devices. Like, the manufacturing lines are just made to crank out small, great-looking screens right now. Small, great-looking screens are a dime a dozen. Processing power, mobile CPUs that are in, you know, like SIP power comparatively to their output, you know, has never been better. There's never been a better power performance ratio than there is with modern mobile chipsets. Tiny screens, even big screens, devices with screens built in seems to be like. That's the thing that people can afford. That's the way manufacturing lines are right now. It makes Nintendo seem so incredibly prescient, just making their console a handheld, basically. Like, you know, because that's where the manufacturing savings are right now. And so it does make me curious about whether or not mobile, for so long, mobile has been the main platform in like Latin America, where Sony and Microsoft and Nintendo have historically not had that kind of distribution. And maybe that's just what takes over. And that interests me because when you imagine the scenario where producers are sitting back and sort of eyeing the indie landscape and seeing, well, what's going to be the next big breakout hit? You know, what's going to be the next thing that was developed in a garage for no money but ends up raking millions of dollars that we can buy the rights to or license? Or, you know, usually lately I feel like that's been some indie PC hit. But in the future, if there are no consoles, you know, the idea is like you release your indie PC hit on Steam and suddenly it breaks out, and then some big publisher decides to pay you millions of dollars so that they can have the rights to publish it on console, right? And make it more accessible to people because that's where they see the profits are. If the consoles aren't there, because no one's buying the consoles because they're too expensive, if there's no longer any profit in the consoles, what incentive is there for big publishers to scoop up those little indie hits and distribute them when indies can largely distribute themselves on the mobile app stores if their device, if their, you know, gameplay fits that kind of input scheme? I don't know. I know we don't have the answers to these questions, but it's just, it feels like a very unprecedented future. It feels very different from anything that's ever happened before, and I don't
Well, I mean, it's like, you know, the Switch 2 just came out, so that's going to be around for a while. You know, if the life is anything like the Switch 1, it's going to go well into the 2030s.
By which time it will cost $1,100.
Probably. But yeah, who knows what a PS6 or a next Xbox looks like. I think they look ridiculous and are too expensive. But not to let Nintendo off the hook here, I thought their Direct was pretty lame as far as Directs go. I was underwhelmed.
When was their Direct?
When
did I see it? Which tells you everything.
Yeah. This was the one that ended with the Ocarina of Time formal announcement that everybody kind of knew was coming.
Okay. I don't remember. I don't know if I watched the full thing. I just saw the announcement. But yeah, I didn't see anything.
I think I had this on in a window while I was working on something else.
Yeah, me too.
I don't remember anything about it.
I remember being it was like 50 minutes long and I was like 35 minutes in. And I'm like, when are they going to announce something that's like just nothing was interesting to me.
I mean, it's fair to say there was nothing there for me. I think they announced that Deltarune Chapter 5 is available today on the eShop. Right. I think that was the day that, you know, Deltarune dropped. And other things that are just not for me, which is fine, I guess.
It's, you know, the Ocarina of Time remake had been leaked months prior, so everyone kind of knew it was coming. And then when they just showed off nothing from it, it was just when it was just an announcement teaser, and it's like, we knew, and now we know for sure, and it's coming out this year. And Nintendo is like that, where they won't show a game until it comes, you know, 2 months before it comes out, and that's fine. That's totally fine.
It's incredible how little they can show of a game too and still make me think it looks like shit. Sorry, that was a hot take. I'm willing to give it a try, but like,
I don't even think it looked bad necessarily, but it didn't look like anything. This looks like a game with, you know, sure. I felt nothing.
I felt nothing.
I didn't feel excited. I didn't feel like negative about it because I'm like, well, this isn't even them playing the game. I mean, show me what that, you know, again, it's just there's nothing to even hang any kind of hat on that. And there was no like new GameCube, like virtual console, what have you, Nintendo Switch Online.
Yeah, that
drop.
Was weird.
I'm just like, okay, just no little tidbit there. Like, okay, all right. Yeah, I mean, Summer Games Fest, like, in general, there was not a whole lot that got me excited.
Yeah, I don't even, like, I know I watched some of it.
I know I wrote stuff down somewhere. I don't know where.
If it was.
I mean, yeah.
I think I wrote some stuff down in a notebook, but I don't know where that notebook is. I think it's in my backpack, and I'm not going to get up and go get it.
Yeah.
Y'all know it was announced.
Let me ask you this. I'm trying to be fair, but I can't help but sort of feel like the very short glimpse we got of Link had a very like generic Unreal Engine look to it. And and I guess that's to be expected when you take the existing art direction and say, how do we make this more realistic? When that art direction was explicitly geared for an unrealistic level of polygonal representation. And I think if the rumors are true that the existence of Switch 2 Star Fox is effectively a pilot to test the engine that they will be using in the Ocarina of Time remake, I know that Star Fox's art direction was also controversial, but I don't hate it as much because there's nothing, you know, to me, the way those Star Fox dudes looked originally, there's no, it's not locked in my, I don't care. I don't care what they look like. those animals could look like whatever. And I think it's fine. If you're going to make them, they look goony and realistic. They look like some fucking Wes Anderson-esque Fantastic Mr. Fox, like the original Star Fox, you know, the puppet box art.
Yeah, the
There's
box art.
Mm-hmm. for that. Whereas with Zelda has always had to have some kind of very deliberate aesthetic, and that's part of the magic of it, you know, that Zelda has art direction. And I don't know, it almost feels like it has been stripped of art direction. It's been stripped of purpose. It's been stripped of perspective to make it palatable to what people think they want. I don't know. Again, I'm going off almost nothing, but I don't like it. I'm not happy.
I don't know. We'll see what it looks like.
Yeah.
When they show
more. Not that Ocarina is even. I don't particularly have any strong feelings about Ocarina to begin with, because it's not one of my favorite games. So.
Did
you play that Star Fox demo at all, Tim?
Yeah, I liked it.
Yeah, I liked it too. That's some Star Fox ass Star Fox.
Yeah, I had played some Star Fox 64 back in the spring, probably brought on by the Mario Galaxy movie. And like, I quite enjoyed the demo.
Yeah, it's a great game.
It's Star Fox. Yeah, it's a great game. Looks nice.
Go ahead, Dave.
I like all the voice acting in it. I like the way that they, you know, much people who love Star Fox 64, which is not, I don't have anything against it, but I don't have any particular nostalgia for it. People that love that game, in general, seem to be appreciating the ways that the plot has been fleshed out, just with more dialogue, really, with actual cutscenes with dialogue. And it's fine, but it's also, to me, one of the examples of how Nintendo's translation reads better than it speaks. Because even in that demo, Fox has some fucking cringy ass lines, like, I don't know, like, so this is what Andross has been up to. I don't know, something that would read better on the page than it speaks out loud. And just makes me wish that, like, if you're gonna go to the trouble to flesh out the plot, Nintendo, just hire a writer.
Hire someone who
like writes dialogue for film. Grab one of the Illumination guys. I don't care. Just grab someone who understands how English sentences should be structured together, and not just localized. It's just their sense of localization always drives me a little nuts.
Yeah,
if you're gonna go to the trouble to make it cinematic, hire a screenwriter. Let somebody help you make it sound fucking human. I've been ranting so much.
Yeah, calm down, Dave.
Off of demos, I don't have a ton to say about, but I played that Rhythm Heaven Groove demo because there's actually a demo.
We vowed to buy it on day one. I haven't even tried the demo.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I'm going to buy it the second it goes on sale because it's Rhythm Heaven, but yeah, go figure. It's really good. I mean, they did, you know, one tier, so, you know, you get to play four games. And
that's pretty generous.
Which is nice. Yeah. So it's great. It does have one of the ugliest menus for whatever reason. I hope it's just for the demo, but I haven't seen a menu look like a placeholder sort of thing. But I mean, it's Rhythm Heaven. It's great. It's so good. I'm just glad it exists.
No, I bought the game. I pre-ordered it and paid in full.
Wow.
I was ready. I just had to walk it and get it.
I bought some discount eShop credit in anticipation of buying the full game on day one.
This was part of my credit for trading in a Resident Evil Requiem when I was done with it.
Okay.
And they had like a trade credit going on. Because I mean, this game is only like $40, I want to say.
Is it only $40 to start?
It's only $40.
Yeah, it's cheap.
$34 for me with my cheap eShop credit.
Yeah. $35 I would certainly pay.
Yeah, so I've played a bit more of it. I think I'm on like the fourth or fifth, set of levels. And yeah, it's great. It's Rhythm Heaven. I thought the stages in the demo, those first, like, you know, they're very simple.
Mm. Yes.
And I've definitely already found some that I think are that I like quite a bit. That are very fun and goofy, and I love any Rhythm Heaven stage where when you screw up, the other ones in the line give you side eye and grimace at you. That is always funny every time. Never not great. the graphics are almost like too clean for me. They're like so sharp and nice. Like I wish they were like grittier and kind of looked a little uglier. But that's not the point.
I agree with that.
There's like 90 mini games in it, so there's tons of stuff that I still haven't played. But it's Rhythm Heaven, so you really just can't go wrong with it at all. Like it's just
what was the last one? Was that Mega Mix or
That was like Mega Mix
one, right?
It was the 3DS digital download.
I forgot that existed. My God.
Yeah, that was the last one really that came late, out.
Okay.
3DS thing.
I'm trying to remember. Yeah, because I think that one I didn't play as. I mean, like, they've all been really good.
Yeah, Fever is really just better. Fever is the one that gets played in my house. The Fever is the one that my kids love. So they, yeah, they've been very hype for this one. But my kids are all very busy this summer, so we have not had a moment to sit down as a family and play play much video games. But what did you play?
Yeah.
Besides
okay. Well,
the
I don't know.
Heaven demo. What if we played? Boys. Yeah.
Well, we'll go. So I mean, I've been
Mina the Hollower. Time to talk about Mina the Hollower. Mina the Hollower.
I mean, I don't have much to say beyond last month because I've never. I kept trying to play more than I did last month, but the game doesn't really let you unless you have a large breadth of time. Like you, it's just not a game to go and pick at, which is kind of why I dropped off in the first place.
That's funny because I've almost found the opposite now. I can definitely feel I can definitely play Mina the Hollower and feel like I am making progress, even just going and knocking off a few enemies. And I'm sure that's probably because I have gotten to the point where I've opened up the world enough where I know where I'm going. I know where to farm some bones if I need them. And I've got so many things to now to attribute my bones to. Right now I'm working on reopening the train station because I would like some fast travel. So if I ever have any spare bones lying around that I'm worried about getting rid of, I just go pay the train station. So I'm about halfway to filling that up right now. Even killing a few enemies is like, oh, this is progress.
That was like the last thing that I did was buy the new train.
Yeah.
And I explicitly had to grind for it because like, I had done the areas that were available to me. So I'm like, well, I have really nothing I can do other than just try to get it as fast as possible, like find a grind spot. And it was stupid because like I had just bought a bunch of stuff and then I realized like, oh, the only thing I have to do now is pay the train. If I had just spent the money that I just made going through Septemberg, I would be fine. But no, I gotta go do some grinding. I did finish it. Yeah. Shortly after, you know, we saw each other.
Yeah, because at that point you had only cleared two
I think
thingies.
Yeah, I had only finished two, and then things went downhill it was a very quick ride to the end. I don't mean the game got worse. That's not what I mean by that.
Okay.
But like I had so I told Dave when I saw him, I had made a boo-boo in my play of Mina the Hollower, and that I did the first area, the crypt that they you to. And then I had made a little switcheroo in my head and mixed up the recommendation for the next area and didn't heed the newspaper. So I ended up going to Bone Beach, which is one of the hardest areas in the game.
Which I'm sure that I've done. Like, I haven't found a place that's like, this is the place. Like, I literally did not feel like I was making progress, which is why I stopped. My very good game. I got mercenary kinged. Where it's just sort of like that's how I'm feeling, where it's just like, great game, I'm missing something, and just letting it go for now.
I did the crypt, which is like out to the east, and then Bone Beach, like I was getting it's because the areas are scaled, like the newspaper is kind of telling you where you need to go in vague directions, and you're not always going to end up going there flawlessly, like whatever, there's still exploration and stuff you have to do, but it wants you to go to the crypt first and then go out west to the bayou. And then I think up to Septemberg, like the autumnal area, and then the mountain.
That's where I'm headed now. Cause I just,
then the Bone Beach and then the sixth area. That's kind of like a little bit obfuscated. I did not have a problem finding it. Some people online apparently were very frustrated about how the game hints or does not hint towards it. But Bone Beach is a motherfucker, especially that early in the game. And instead of like heeding my own advice and saying like, you know what, I need to go somewhere else right now. This is, but it was like, I was getting progressing just enough and that, you know, it was giving me, I was just like, okay, this isn't impossible. You know, I'm not getting completely flattened. And I ended up playing through the whole area with some just absolute super tough boss and just being like, what, why is this game this hard? This boss is ridiculous. This is so ridiculously hard. And then only
you told
after
me that
I got
second
out,
tower climb, that second tower climb too. You
yes,
were like,
the
what
tower
the hell?
Climb. Yeah, the tower climb that you have to do after each of the areas. Like, it was so hard. I'm like, God, this is ridiculous.
This
and
a
then
huge
I pieced
jump
together
from what I just did.
And then I pieced together. I'm like, oh, I just did a very late game area. but I was like set for the game after that. Hang on, talk amongst yourselves. My child's being an ignoramus. Right. Hang on.
You said over text that you were where I was at when I first started playing the game, which, I wish I could pinpoint the exact time at which the game started clicking for me. And I don't necessarily know that there is a time, but what I will say is that, it's hard for me in games like these, games that give you a lot of choice to deviate from what I feel like the game wants me to do. And like,
right.
I feel like the game wants you to use that fucking whip. I feel like the game wants that, like, that is the default weapon. And I feel like that must be what the game is balanced around. But I bought the shield instead because
there's a shield. I didn't even see a shield.
So there's like, okay. I think there's, you know how at the start of the game, they give you a choice of three. You can choose the daggers, or the hammer. And so beyond those, there's also a shield and a like a blaster of some kind. There's a straight up a ranged blaster. Cool. So I haven't tried the hammer and I haven't tried the daggers, but I feel like I should because I bought the shield thinking that it was going to be purely a defensive addition. I felt like I didn't have a way to defend myself.
Feels like the way I would have gone.
But it turns out the shield is an offensive weapon and it's got a parry on it. And again, not typically the kind of weapon I gravitate toward.
Okay.
But like I'm nailing the parry window. Like it came really easily to me. And so this just feels so much better to play than the whip does. Comparatively, the whip feels like slow and inaccurate. And I'm like, I'm not sure where this is hitting. And like, because it's so long, whereas I feel like the shield, because it's so short, you kind of have to get right on top of an enemy. So there's a bit of risk, but like, you know, when it hits, like its range of motion is so short. It's like, nope, I'm fucking hitting you. I know, you know, if I'm far away, I'm avoiding. And if I'm close to you, I'm fucking hitting you. If I hit you at the right time, I parry you and do double the damage. So that's been like, just getting that shield has made everything so easier for me. And I'm glad that I deviated from the whip because I'm generally afraid to do that. I'm like, oh, you know, the game was designed around this. But
because I'll usually be like my second play, which never happens. But when I get to a second play.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's
like for me, I mean, even the beginning basic barriers that are there that I'm sure there are easy answers for, like how to get east. Like there's a kid with a kite and there's a bunch of spikes on the bridge. And I did not find a way to solve either of those.
Yeah. Oh, those spikes.
Yeah. So I was like, okay, I got to go other places.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, that is what I'm finding I love about it. It's that, while it has, I was also disappointed at first because I was really expecting a Zelda game.
Yep.
And ultimately now I'm glad that it is not that because there's already a ton of those, but you know, there are very few top down Zelda like games that really truly incorporate this level of open worldness. I really do think it does a great job of combining like the intricacy of something like Link's Awakening, where you will see something up in the upper corner that you can't get at, but in 2 or 3 hours from now you'll suddenly find yourself up here and you'll be like, oh, I was never supposed to get at that thing directly. I was always supposed to find it accidentally, you know, when I eventually wind up here. You know, you get that. There's that sense of delight is there. You know, seeing those those things happen in the natural course of play. But also, that open world in the sort of I guess, Souls-like design. It's the thing that Tim tried to sell me on Elden Ring on, is that if something is bothering you, if you're butting your head against something, just head in another direction because there's six other things to do at any given time.
I just ran out of stuff. And that's kind of what happens with open worlds. just open worlds a hard sell. Like if I didn't know genre wise going in.
Neither did I.
Yeah, exactly.
I guess I will also say, and I guess I have to preface this by saying, Jake Kaufman, if somehow you are deigning to listen to our podcast right now, please know that I love your work. I'm such a big fan of your work. And so when I say that the tunes in Mina the Hollower are not nearly as hummable as Shovel Knight, they're not instantly, hooky. That the shovel, those Shovel Knight tunes are going to be in, they're in my brain forever, and I can instantly recall them and start tapping my toe to them. And the music in Mina is not that, but I get what you're doing, Jake. It is definitely like it's beautiful, intricate work. The particular games that you're evoking, I'm totally picking up on what you're laying down. But it's not catchy and toe tapping like Shovel Knight was.
Yeah, and I don't usually go through a soundtrack until I play a game, but like I pretty much been done on this one, so it's like going through and I was like, well, maybe I need the connotation to listen to a bit,
because there are some great tunes in there. They're just not, he's going for this, and that's the thing. I can tell when he's going for something more Castlevania-ish as well, but Castlevania itself was also sort of this, like a goth rock style, and he's not really doing that either. It's more the gothic, style without like the rock beat behind it to make it catchy. Is fine. Jake Kaufman can do what he wants. Tim, Jake Kaufman knows he's talented. He doesn't need my validation when I say that the music in Mina is not nearly as catchy as Shovel Knight.
It's not just catchy overall. Yeah. There's some really good songs in there though.
Like for the Castlevania stuff, there is also the Blood Rain soundtrack that he did. Definitely throw that on it if it's been a while. Blood Rain really Betrayal. It's good.
Tim, I was suggesting to Weiss
this document at all. Oh. All right.
I was suggesting to Weiss that he might try a different main weapon. Once I bought the shield, I've never looked back.
I use the club gun. Well, when you get to the end, it tells you what weapon you use the most, and it still said the whip, and I'm guessing because in terms of time, I spent so much time going through Bone Beach. but then the rest of the game, it was pretty much all the club gun thing.
I have not bought the club gun.
I might have found it in a chest. No, I think I bought it. There are certain chests that give you like weapon upgrades or weapons and stuff like that.
I just beat lion. At the sort of the foot of the gates of Lionel's castle, there's a treasure chest, and you try to approach it, and a lion drops out of the sky and beats your ass. I just beat him and got a whip upgrade, and I have not used the whip in literally hours. It's been all shield all the time, because I just happened to really click with the parry window because the shield has a great parry. And I've been just destroying it. It's just the shield, and I've tried to switch back to the whip, and I'm like, nah, I like that shield better.
Once you get accustomed to one, that it can be hard to go back. Cause I just liked having the at a moment's notice being able to shoot something across the screen, with the gun.
I should try.
And I didn't have that much trouble like charging it back up with just like getting some hits in. In normal windows of opportunity.
I'm less inclined to switch in this game because it's not like a Castlevania Dawn game where you have all these weapons at your disposal and can switch instantly. The fact that you can only switch at a save point has not exactly engendered me toward experimentation. Once I've got the bones, I should try some other things, I suppose.
Yeah, I did have, you know, in terms of, I did end up liking the game, like, a lot overall, like, once I got through it, even though my difficulty curve was very skewed to be, like, normal to very hard, and then just kind of coasting the rest of the game. I still kind of struggle with what they did with the sidearms, where it's like you want particular ones, and you have to go find them in the world, basically. Mm-hmm. Like, and that you don't get to keep them when you die unless you've bought that upgrade, which is important. You know, the earlier you buy that, the less of a problem that is. But it was a little bit for me that I didn't see the Hollower's Guild right away. That was like a later. I was like halfway through the game. Like halfway through my playtime was when
crazy to me.
I went back or I just saw something mentioned about a Hollower's Guild and I was like, oh, right, that. And then I was like, oh, it's just right here at the beginning.
Right at the beginning, right at the gates of the town. Gates of the town.
I just didn't think about, like, I didn't put too much thought into being able to get into that building in particular. And then I never walked past it again for the next 10 hours or so. And then it's like, oh, this is how you get a rudimentary map of the world. And this is how you unlock all of these upgrades for your hideout that, you need for. Yes. Yep. Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, I mean, I've been in that town for probably 5 hours or so. Well, I'm sure.
I also missed this. So this is why it's kind of a problem that they don't.
Right.
Like, there is no fucking reason it should be difficult to go in there and get this stuff rolling. And it's not difficult, but it's like that just that little bit of like you can't just like walk in the door. You have to be able to like go around and like hit some piece of trash that will let you like go into the building. And then you have to go. Well, once you go in there, you get the quest that it's like, oh, somebody has been kidnapped down to the south. And then you have to go rescue the guy. And then it's like you can start upgrading like your underlab with stuff that like refills your whatever your resource for using the sidearms for keeping a sidearm down there. And all kinds of stuff. And it's just like,
yeah, it feels like it should lead you in that direction.
Yeah, you should just kind of be more directly presented with that without any friction whatsoever, you know? Yeah. Like,
so, I'm like, map? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, it is an odd choice. I told Tim when we saw each other a couple of weeks ago that it felt organic because the first I think the first sidearm I found was the axe, which has an arc to it, which I suddenly realized, oh, I need to destroy this piece of junk on the other side of this thing. I need something that can arc. I'll arc my axe over this, destroy this piece of junk, so then I can jump there and jump again, and now I can get inside this building I've been trying to get inside. Oh, this is the Hollower's Guild. Great. To me, it felt very spelled out, but if you missed any one part of that, you'd be like, where is this place? What's going on? But also, strictly speaking, it's nothing you need, right? I mean, there's technically no one thing in this game that you need because the systems are so not interlocking, but overlapping and compensating for each other that you could very well play through the entire game without accessing whole, entire, kinds of sidearms or never trying any of the other basic weapons like I have. And that's something that I'm loving about the game is that nothing feels necessary, even that basic rudimentary stuff. And I think it's because I'm really trying, and Tim, this is to your credit, I am trying to embrace that Dark Souls ethos of I'm just going to pick at this. I'm going to be patient. I'm going to swallow my pride. I'm going to pick at this meticulously. I'm not going to catch everything, but I'm going to figure it out. I'm going to find my own way. I'm going to grind it out. And that's been incredibly rewarding for me.
Yeah. Hell yeah.
I did it. Yeah.
You did it. Overcame. But yeah, then I know the game is all a lot of people.
Sekiro.
There's all kinds of, accessibility things you can turn on to kind of make the game a little more palatable. And that's fine. You know, if you need to go that route, it's cool, whatever. But yeah, I think the game definitely, I think, caught some people off guard with how much more Soulsy it is than, you know, kind of at first blush, it was like, oh, it's like a Castlevania-y Zelda game.
That's what I thought.
Would that?
Yep.
All, it's like, no, it's a Soulsy Zelda game.
Weesh was just remarking he had no idea how open world it was, which to me is proving to be the big draw is that it is doing that open world Zelda thing where it's still this intricately designed world where mm-hmm. there are secret passages that double back on themselves and lead you to a thing that you saw you couldn't access before.
Yeah. I will say that I feel like the areas themselves are pretty contained. Like you're not going to spill over between it's not like a, you know, there's tons of secret passages that flop between different areas. Like when you're in Bone Beach, you're in Bone Beach.
Yeah.
Like there's maybe a couple places where it pops out in other ones. So it's not like this intricately woven thing where you're going to, you know, kind of be wandering back and forth and not know where you're going.
It's more that way in the central area near where the town is.
Yes. Yeah. That hub. You can mm-hmm. go anywhere from there and find yourself into any of the main areas and start progressing and just think like, oh, well, this is the way I'm supposed to go because there's nothing gating me from going here and then just be getting absolutely
wrecked,
fucking smacked. Yeah.
I'm just trying to see where that fucking Hollower's Guild is.
The main gate of the town, the very front gates.
Yeah, it's like the south part of town, like in the middle, like main section, I want to say.
Yeah. Like I tried jumping over. Whatever. Okay.
It's like a building to the right of the entrance. You just have to go around to the right side of the building and like hit something and then you can go into it. Mm. It's ridiculous.
You got to jump over those things, but you got to break the destructible things around the things you have to jump over first. I would also like to point out for whatever this means to anyone for the price of games, hardware and accessibility, that this new release indie hit runs pretty flawlessly on my $100 Android based handheld, playing the Steam version through Game Native. That machine runs Snapdragon 6th generation, which is like 6 years old at this point. And obviously this build of the game is not designed for that processor. It's not, tailored like it would be if this was like a Switch port, say. And it still runs great. So, you know, there is a way to have low-cost hardware play a very large library of new release games. Mm-hmm. Like, it exists. It's possible. And so far, it is only a thing that enthusiasts know about. And, you know, like a small segment of enthusiasts really are availing ourselves of. But I don't know. I feel like it could be a big deal. Just if the people.
Yeah, it feels like that's not a way that people are going to go to try to play games. Mm. I mean, does it play on Switch 1? You know,
right.
There was a lot on Mina. What else have people had?
I would like to. So there is one game that we have been kind of playing as a family, and it's a game that I saw a lot of writers talking about on social media a couple weeks ago. It's called Librarian, with the A and the R in the middle of that word capitalized for some reason. I'm not sure why. That's the only way it's like searchable, I guess. So the game is called Librarian. It's a new release game. It is $6. And this is a game in which you are presented with a library where all the books have been knocked off the shelf and you have to
reshelve
them. Oh, this is
the arcane library. AI generated something. Cool.
I don't think, is something about it AI generated?
That's what I heard. Yeah.
Oh no. Somebody gosh, I hope not. Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't mean to rain on your parade.
No, I wonder if it's like procedurally generated somehow, because there's a lot of, there's 3,000 books that have fallen off, you know, because that would be nice, actually, if there was a way to like procedurally generate each run so that each run was a little different.
One UI component and three landscape paintings used as wall decorations were produced using additional AI for refinement.
Ooh.
None were created from AI from the ground up. AI helped with grammatical corrections for in-game text, which were then carefully reviewed and adjusted by hand. So I don't know. Take it as you will.
All right.
There's an AI disclosure on it. All right. Sorry, I didn't mean to poo-poo on you.
No, it's okay. It is a like slow methodical game where you have to pick up books and shelf them in the right order and it's meditative and very nice.
Oh, shit.
In a very sort of Pac-Man pick up all these dots way. So yeah, no, I was about to recommend it wholeheartedly. As the game goes on, you get abilities that let you shelf the books faster and easier, which almost I feel like was enticing at first, but then I was like, nah, you know what? I kind of miss when this was hard. Because when it was hard, it was slow and methodical, and I was looking forward to this just being a never-ending, basically, jigsaw puzzle that we could each pick, you know, take our time assembling a little bit. Like, just leaving a jigsaw puzzle out on the dining room table, and anyone can come and help themselves and put away a few pieces, and we would all solve it as a family. But then Julia got all these abilities and very quickly advanced way beyond the rest of us, and the rest of us kind of lost interest. But for $6, it was super cool. Make your own decisions about those AI disclosures, I guess. I'll review them myself. But yeah, Librarian. It's awesome. Cool. $6.
Yeah, yeah.
Tim, I regret to inform you that I have not touched Titanium Court since Mina the Hollow. Since Mina the Hollower sank its hooks into me, Titanium Court has fallen woefully by the wayside. Yeah, I don't know if I'm ever going to get back to it.
Hey, So that was the next thing I was going to talk about, because after Mina the Hollower, I did end up popping back onto, well, I played some other stuff, which we'll talk about in a second, but I did end up kind of popping back into Titanium Court for another few hours or so. And I don't know at this point if I'm going back to it.
Okay.
I'm kind of like, there was so much about that game that I like and enjoy. Yeah. Like, it has this, you know, the puzzle aspect of it and kind of starting to figure out some of the strategy and like the meta strategy game that's layered over it with like producing your units and how to get through the levels most efficiently and like solve the game's weird list of problems that it presents with you. It presents to you. And I was enjoying kind of all the quirky characters and dialogue to it. Yeah. Until I wasn't, and I just kind of ran out of steam with that shit. and I was like kind of ready to be done with the game, and it kind of pulled the rug out from under me. And I'm like, okay, you know, like, okay, this is a thing that's going to happen. Like, let me stick with this a little more and kind of keep poking at it. Also somewhere in here, there was a point at which, like, I was talking to a character about how to like escape the court, and like, he does this little, you know, fourth wall breaking aside where he's just like, you know, you can just turn off the game. And I'm just kind of like, should I just turn off the game?
that's an option.
But, you know, I was, you know, just trying to, and then like something else kind of like, I'm trying to get these keys back into my possession. And I have been running out of patience with like every kind of interaction you have with like the fairies in your court, like them just popping off for like so many lines of dialogue. Cause they're just, there's just a bunch of idiots, and it's like charming to a point. At this point, it's like, okay, yes, I don't need like this whole, like, huge explanation about why you don't want to fight a vending machine or attack it.
Yeah.
Like, I'm like, okay, I guess, you know, we're doing this again. And like, you know, we're arguing about road signs. You guys don't think cars exist.
I get it.
And
had we discussed the song about Trout, I think.
Okay. No, I hadn't seen that.
Okay.
Until recently, where it's like, you know, I got to the end of a run, and it presents you with the option of like, hey, do you want to listen, like, instead of fighting the boss of the run, do you want to watch a musical performance and pretend that you won, which is totally fine by me.
Yeah.
Cause you go through these runs, and sometimes you just want to make the progress that might happen after a run.
Yeah.
There's multiple songs.
Oh, are there?
Yes.
Cause that
there's more
song
than one.
Was very long. And I guess,
yes, like, it was.
I always appreciate a little bit of FMV, I guess, yes. in any game. Mm. But also, I like, that was kind of the moment where I was like, is this clever or is it just self-indulgent?
Yes.
I honestly don't know anymore.
Yep. That was like kind of the moment. It was cute at first. And as it kept going on and on and on, and I couldn't skip it, I'm like, oh, are you just flying up your own ass here? Are you sniffing your own farts a little too much here? And then there was like another one that was another very long song about ballerinas. And then I was being presented with a song again. I'm like, I don't think I ever want to listen to one of your songs again, buddy. And then it's like, and then that compounds on top of like all the dialogue, like being a bit too much, and like kind of the cheeky way in which, you know, the game keeps perpetuating itself. And I'm just kind of like, okay, I think I've done enough with Titanium Court. Like, I played like 12 hours of it.
Yeah.
And I thought I was close to done with it, and then I was not close to done with it. And that was a real like gut punch. And I tried to roll with that gut punch, and now I'm just like, you know, I think I'm satisfied with Titanium Court. And it did not set my world on fire like it did so many of the games journos that I follow back in the spring. Maybe they didn't play enough of it. Maybe it was like after, you know, a few hours, there's this sweet spot of like nonsense and gameplay where things like, are hitting.
This is wacky and the gameplay's starting to click with me and this game might be kind of fun and it'll be over in two more hours. Nope.
No, it just keeps going.
It just keeps going.
It just keeps going. And
this guy wrote so much text.
Yeah. Like, I think if it got you out the door, if it got you out the door quicker, and then it's like, oh, if you want to hang around and play more, you know, do more of the extra game stuff,
that would have been more welcome. Yeah.
Yeah, I think. But as it is now, yeah, I think I'm satisfied with Titanium Court for now.
Also runs excellent on my very paltry Android hardware, by the way. Mm-hmm. So new release games just running fine on very cheap system on a chips. We don't need $1,000 consoles.
So yeah, a few other things inspired by our hot date. Actually, no, a couple other things. I forgot something else I forgot to write down.
Yeah, me and Dave, listeners about our hot date.
Yeah,
but that's what we were about to see. All right.
Yeah. That's where I was going. Yeah, no, a couple weeks ago in the middle of June, me and Dave got together and went to see Bit Brigade again.
Should have worn a t-shirt today. I forgot.
With Super Guitar Brothers again, which was the last show we went to. I went to see them in Rochester, and they were debuting. That was when they were on their Mario World F-Zero tour. This is their Mega Man X tour, and they played in Buffalo. So Dave came out here. We went and played some pinball at Pocketeer, a awesome pool hall / pinball, massive pinball arcade that's just a few miles down the road from my house.
A certain Ben Lathan joined us for that, even.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, he did show up. Yeah.
Yeah, it was an incredible time. Tim, this pool hall is truly spectacular. And like I went to my local pinball place for my birthday a couple days later, which is what I asked my wife and children if they would please do with me. And you know, that place is always delight, but like always a delight. But I just couldn't, you know, it honestly paled in comparison to that pool hall, by your house, which is just cavernous and filled to the brim with machines, new and old, machines that I'd never seen in the wild before. Just like, what a place. Absolutely incredible. And that it's a full bar with bar food and pool tables.
Yeah.
It's just really cool. I had a great time. Bit Brigade. So I've since tried to explain to civilians about Bit Brigade and how I came away from that, Tim. Basically, this is how I tell the story. I say, I went with my friend Tim, who's quite tall, and I'm very short. So I pushed right to the front of that little music hall. I was like, this was not a concert venue, because like my neighbors, they go to concerts. They go to stadiums. Mm-hmm. They go to see the big bands that they love in very large music venues. And I'm like, no, the concerts I've been to lately have been in like, you know, music halls. And like, I'm not going to a concert. I'm going to a rock show. And and so I pushed us right up to the front. And I know that, Tim, you did not need to. I'm like, nah, I'm short. I can't see. I want to get right up to the front. I want this band to melt my face off. And when they started playing, it was the loudest thing I had ever heard in my earthly existence. I thought I was going to have like a heart arrhythmia because I could just feel the like the double pedal pounding of the bass drum
in
my chest. It was so loud. It was the most. And like, I'm trying to explain this to the civilians and they're like, but it's video game music. Isn't it just blips and bloops? I'm like, you don't understand. How can I make you understand?
You were watching a metal band.
We were watching a metal band.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Rock our socks off.
I was going to say, you're listening to the source material or blips and blops. That does not mean the
the compositions themselves are searing, face-melting, you know, guitar epics. And then at the same time, watching some truly balletic performance on Mega Man X, like watching a true maestro just like dodge and weave his way through that game with taking nary a hit, just blazing through like painstakingly memorized routes. Just incredible stuff. Yeah, what a show.
Yeah, it was a hell of a performance. And that's what I said is like they are not speed running the games anymore. They are performing them. They are showing off the game for the audience. Like that's what they did with Mario World. Like it was not the most optimized route through Mario World. Like, no, they did a tour through every single part of Mario World. It wasn't like all exits. It wasn't the fastest route. It was just like, we are just going to take you on a tour through Mario World and we are going to play a bunch of different Mario music as we go through it. Like we're going to, cause we're not going to speed run these other 15 Mario games and do sets for each of them. We're going to do this Mario game and we're going to play a bunch of Mario music on the way through it. And they did something similar with Mega Man X where, you know, it's like, okay, we don't need to play this boss theme again. We are going to play a boss theme from a later Mega Man X game.
Yeah.
We are going to dip into some other Maverick Hunter Maverick music from later Mega Man X games. We're gonna sprinkle some other stuff in there to keep it interesting, to keep it on your toes. We're
very
not gonna play
judicious decisions in terms of curating a performance.
Yeah, we are not going to play the stage select music every single time.
Yeah.
Like they figured some stuff out along the way. Of you know, it's okay to kind of take a like this is a little bit different than things used to be, where it felt like they are doing everything in time with the games that they are playing. But this is more like more of a broader brush over things. And Super Guitar Brothers are also very good.
Lovely.
Just great. They got a new album, which I picked up. It's somewhere within reach of me, but I don't want to dig for it right now. Lot of great song selections on there. But a couple event directions we could take here. I could talk about pinball, or I could talk about because of this, I went and I've replayed Mega Man X 1, 2, and 3. Got back into just to kind of, you know, I couldn't help myself. There was a couple years ago where I replayed the NES Mega Mans just to kind of reevaluate them, and I felt pretty much the same way that I do about them. Where it's like, yeah, you know, Mega Man 1 is kind of its own thing. Mega Man 2 is a classic. Mega Man 3 would be the best one if the Doc Robot stages didn't suck so bad. Mega Man 4, I just have a general soft spot for, and I think is really good. Mega Man 5, I think is boring. I know a lot of people disagree with me and love that one. I'm just kind of and 6 is made surprisingly fun by the Rush Jet. Just having the little temporary jetpack is great.
I think I agree on everything except I would have to go back to 6.
Yeah.
Like I remember just not being kind of middle of the road with
it. Yeah. It's really, yeah, the bosses are weird, but that kind of stands out on its own. Mm-hmm. You know, that's where they were having like a World Cup of robot fights. And so they're all like themed around countries.
Right.
Means that like trying to figure out the boss order just makes no sense whatsoever. Cause there's no, well, there is a fire one and a cold one, and the fire does work on the cold one. But after that, you're kind of up a tree, and trying to figure out what a morning star will work on or a tomahawk. But you know, Mega Man X, the first one is awesome, man. Did they nail that one out of the gate? Just like great boss designs, great music, great weapons. So fun, just kind of.
Oh, Tim froze for me.
Really, like the sub tanks and the health extensions and the armor upgrades and stuff like that. What?
Okay. No, it's fine now. You had both frozen X2, for me, but you're fine now.
Yeah. Okay, cool.
Oh, okay.
X2 was one where I was like, you know, it felt easy to me at the time, but like it was still fun. And X3, I remember just being like hard, but really good. And also having really good music. They all have really good music for the most part. Yeah. But yeah, X1 still, you know, feel the same way about it. X2, some of the boss fights are kind of boring in that game. The tongue soup that he's in for like a second, you shoot him once and then he goes back into the water and shoots out blades at you. And then like, you got to sit there and wait for him to show up again. Like Magna Centipede teleports around. So you have to wait for him to reappear to hit him with some junk, and like Crystal Snail, you can't shoot all the time. So there's like all these, some boss battles in the game that are just kind of tedious that you got to wait through. There's a lot of slowdown in X2, more so than in the other ones I noticed. Still good. X3 is hard. Also, I think might be kind of just fucking stupid with the amount of stuff they added to it. Like just the route through it, because they have the stuff from the previous games, and both X2 and X3 suffer because they added in these weird little hunter bosses in the middle, like extra bosses that just don't need to be there and are just kind of annoying. But X3 layered in, like, they were like, we're going to go wild with the power armor thing. And you're going to get four different types of power armor that you can get to. And, you know, some upgrades you need, like, the boots for, and some you need, like, the charged up weapon for. And you need this weapon specifically with the charged up weapon. But some other things you need, like, the mech for. But, like, to get any mech, you need to get the one mech from this one stage, which is probably the last one you're going to play, because you're going to play the Blizzard Buffalo stage first, because that's where you get the boots from, and you need the boots first. Uh-huh. Right. But then it's like so many of the things you need to unlock. You need the charged up buster with the Volt Catfish weapon specifically. So it's like, you need all this different stuff, and it's just kind of like all over the place and annoying. And it's like, by the time you get all this stuff, like you're backtracking through the levels. Like you're not having this stuff for the first time through a level. It's just inefficient backtracking at that point. And even then, it's like one of the mech suits is like a frog underwater suit that's only useful in one area of one stage to get like one upgrade, but you can't get it until like you do like two other things from two other levels. And just kind of exhausted with it. So I'm not sure if X3 is really the best designed one there is.
Yeah, that's fair.
Other than that, yeah. X1. Yeah, they're all still good. But X3. Well, X3 is also tuned a little bit because you can switch to zero. So you do get like another life bar to play around with in those levels. So they might be a little bit harsher because of that. Also,
X3's got those cool like wireframe polygonal effects, because
both X2 and X3.
Oh, X2 too. Oh, okay.
X2 has some stuff as well. Yeah,
neat.
Both of them. X3 is like, it's the weapons when you get them, so they come out as a wireframe and they like spin around in all different directions before they go off screen. It's just like, you guys are just kind of stunting around right now.
We got them too, PlayStation. We got polygons too. Anyway, go on.
Yeah. Also an old game I played, Beetle Adventure Racing for the Nintendo 64.
Oh, what brought that on?
It came up on like Giant Bomb, like they did a review of it. And I was like, you know, I never played that game. I should check that game out, because I remember it being like well received at the time, surprisingly well received. And yeah, it's a really good game. Really good racing game.
Well remembered too. And I have tried many times to boot it up because people say like, oh, this is the secret best racer on N64. I've tried many times to boot it up and dive in, and I always have a good time with it, but I've never stuck with it past like one or two races, and I'm not sure why it hasn't drawn me in, because everyone, it's pretty universally beloved.
Yeah. I think it's better after you get past like the first circuit and you unlock some faster cars.
Maybe that's
The racing feels better then.
Yeah.
But yeah, just like they're big, long levels.
Yeah.
Big, long tracks. So they're meaty. Like a race takes like 6, 7, 8 minutes. And you know, the whole thing at the time and the thing about the game really is that there's just like tons of shortcuts and secrets in every level.
Yeah.
And that's like discovering that stuff is what makes it fun. And trying to figure out the optimal route to go through one of those tracks, because it's like, you don't want to go the same ways like on each lap, because each shortcut has like its own like bonus boxes that you want to pick up.
Yeah.
So you kind of want to do like, well, I just want to take this shortcut on this lap so I can get those bonuses and then take a different route on the next lap.
As far as I know, the studio that developed it too, they were, I believe, a British studio or at least a European studio, and don't really have any other big racing hit, because a lot of times it'll be like, oh yeah, no, this racing game was actually developed by Sumo Digital. You know, Sumo Digital just had their hands in so many racers over the years. But I don't believe this particular team has any other like racing pedigree before or since. I think
Bielema
was kind of an anomaly. Right.
I did see that there was a skeet that talked about some of the people that worked on the game went on to do some pretty massive things.
Oh, okay.
So like the team might not have stayed together. The company doesn't have a pedigree, but like some of the people that worked on it, like did go crazy.
Oh, good.
later on. Yeah. So there is a history there. Last thing about pinball.
All right.
Because I played. This was like the newest table from Stern. This was in the pinball hall like the week after Dave was there.
Say literally the name one again. Week you're later. Talking about the new Transformers G1 table, yes?
Yes, because the Transformers G1 pinball.
We had a little audio glitch on Discord. So just to clarify,
yeah, that's what it is. They put out the Pokemon table a few months ago. This is their new one, the Transformers one. It is fun if like a little bit, lacking, I would say. It's a fun table. Like it's G1 cartoon, like you're pulling up familiar episodes and kind of like accomplishing goals related to those episodes.
That's neat.
But like it just kind of, and you know, shooting around the table and like, you know, the effects and like the stuff going on the screen is all very cool, but like in terms of like gimmickry, it definitely falls a little short. Like I think everyone looked at the table and kind of expected that the Optimus Prime model on the table was going to transform.
That would be
but apparently it does not do that. And I don't know whether it's confirmed or just speculated that Stern couldn't get the mechanics of it like consistent enough for it to happen. And the thing is, there's two versions of the table. There's like I don't remember what the names of the tiers are, but one's $10,000 and the other's $15,000.
Oh,
and yeah, I'm not hating on Pocketeer for getting the cheaper version, but the $15,000 version is the one that has the fully functional like sound wave gimmick on the table that captures your balls for multi-ball and then shoots them out of his chest.
Oh, that sounds bad. What arcade operator is going to pay for that when there's two versions?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the thing. A bummer. You got to pay for like the high end, the premium version to have that. But without that, it's kind of like you still, you know, Soundwave still locks your balls from multi-ball, but he's just doing it on some lane or like place up in the, you know, somewhere up on the field. It's not like you're not getting that tactile sense of balls actually going inside of Soundwave and then shooting out of his chest.
I want the tactile feels of balls going inside.
Yes. And there's just like this kind of like little like acrylic standee of, Soundwave just kind of there in its place. It just feels a little empty. Yeah, because in the version they originally showed, you know, they have that Soundwave there, and then there's like a Grimlock model on the other side, and those are not present in the version of the machine I played. So it ended up feeling a little plain. But also, there's supposed to be a gimmick where like your ball will go into Megatron's fusion cannon and he shoots it out. Ooh. And I felt for sure that I had done that. Like it went up there behind him. I'm like, okay, even on the screen, like Optimus Prime's like loading a ball into Megatron on the thing and getting ready to shoot it into space. And that didn't come out. It just shot out somewhere else. And I lost my ball. Cause I was like, staring at the fusion cannon, ready for like the Megatron shit to happen, and then it didn't. And I was like, but apparently that is in the game, but like I just didn't accomplish it. So yeah. Like, I don't know.
So it's half your fault.
Also, the first time that I ever got a free ball on the match, the two digits at the end.
Nice.
So that was pretty cool. Got a free game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Help ease the blow. Awesome. Yeah. Any disappointment.
Yeah. And then I was at the Strong next week, and I don't know if they had their machines on like the gas or something, but I got like three free games. I used three coins and played like nine games of pinball across three machines because I just kept getting free games.
Oh,
yeah.
Man.
So that was pretty cool. That's what all the stuff day. I played that I'm going to talk about
all right.
for now.
Oh, good, great Ooh. Stuff. Yeah, I really wanted to something I have not had the opportunity to do is go, because like on my birthday, my kids came out and I think it's probably the most time that they've ever spent with pinball tables, like, and actively, like, you know, started enjoying themselves. they're always patient with Dad, but for some reason that night they were just really game to give it a try, and I meant to boot up some of the Farsight pinball collections for them so that they could like sort of keep that party rolling, like, oh, you know, Julia, you were actually doing really good at Pinbot there. Let's play this a little more at home and you can, you know, like we'll start hitting some table goals. And but I never had the time to capitalize on that, unfortunately. Couldn't strike while that iron was hot. But yeah, everyone knows that That's we love cool, us though. Some pinball over here. On the Fat Gatsby podcast. Weiss, I know that you said you didn't have a lot else that you had played. Was there anything else you wanted to touch
on? Games I got nothing. I got one movie in that I literally saw before this podcast, if we transition over to that. But okay. We're in the middle of games, so... I finally got to see Jackass.
Okay. Yeah.
It's been tauntingly in the theaters, and... The Furious is not playing in my Regal, so which I've heard nothing but great things. But yeah, no, if you want just it's the kind of the and now for something completely different of Jackasses, it's sort of a best of with new stuff in there. It's very, I don't know, it's crazy that they existed in the first place. They opened the movie with Knoxville's stunt that they couldn't show on MTV in the first place, so that was super cool. I'll leave that to imagination if you haven't heard of that one, but no, it's I don't know, it they did a nice job mixing old stuff with some stunts that are still genuinely crazy to see in 2026. This I actually believe him in that this will be the last one finally. Especially after like the bull stunt from 4, where he spins, I think, 720 degrees ish when hit. Yeah, it's bad. they show that again, but no, it's awesome. If you want that hit and you want to cry with the boys, and it is a good time. And it's just incredibly nostalgic to think of like MTV Films and Dick House and like especially like early 2000s. I don't know, like a lot has been written between Jackass 4 and 5 on the non-toxic masculinity that Jackass has kind of turned into, especially like 3 onward, where it's like it's obviously very bro, but they're also supportive.
I will confess right now, if you guys didn't already know, I've never actually seen any of the Jackass movies.
I knew you were light on them.
It's exactly zero, and I think you know those times when you guys were going out to see, that was just the product of us going to different schools and not going out to see movies
that makes
at the
sense
time. And like so much, as you just said, so much has been written lately about like these guys have such deep meaning for, you know, that there is about the, you know, what does it mean to be able to sublimate The affection that you have for your friend, that you know their asshole mm-hmm. so well. I think this might have been one of the Aftermath writers, like writing about mm-hmm. how like they know each other's asshole. They know every wrinkle on each other's yeah. assholes. That's how intimate they are. That's how, you know, do you about mm-hmm. your friends? No. So how close are you to your friends? I've always kind of wanted an on-ramp, but I also know that I don't, the people in my immediate household are not candidates for this. And so I feel like I need some other jackass virgins who are willing to make this mm-hmm. leap with me. I don't know where I find that community. Maybe I just go out to the theater and see the newest one.
No, I didn't get to go to, but one of our local indie chains that is very good, our Hyper Real Film Club, did a whole week of Jackass 1 through 4. Oh, they got Jackass 3D in 3D, which is like incredible. Like, once again, shot by Spike Jonze in some of the best 3D from the era of like it's Coraline and Jackass 3D and Dread 3D. Those are like the best 3D
those
movies.
Are the 3D movies.
Yep. Yeah. Just seeing a dildo flying at you in 60 frames per second. It's incredible. because 5 has such a, you know, is such a timepiece of like going back and forth between old and new footage. Like, that could be a good entrance point, because it is like the best ofs they chose are truly a lot of like of the, yeah. truly the best
they
of
earned
stuff.
That moniker.
Yeah. And also, like I'm always down with everything except the gross stuff. Like, I get through that. But the nice thing is you have your surrogate in that it became such a runner that amazing cinematographer Lance Bangs, who also shoots a lot of, like, stand-up and music videos and such, is the prime candidate for, like, throwing up. So, like, the bits don't become about the bit. They become what's Lance doing during this bit. So now you have the games within the games. And that's kind of what's built, especially since 2 or 3 onward.
Yeah, I was going to say it from 2. It's like it stopped being about them pranking people and about them fucking with each other.
Exactly. Yeah. Yep. That's when it really, I think a lot of people love the first Jackass movie because it was kind of like, it's kind of the last of the pure continuation of the show, because it is that, but 2 onward and has games within the games.
And I find that deeply interesting, because that speaks to this sort of sense that you're a fly on the wall there on a film set, right? And you are feeling the camaraderie that comes with it's 2 a.m. and we've done 16 takes and we're laughing our faces off. And, you know, we all crave that. Thus, filmmakers crave that.
Yeah. Yep. It's like, we have some bit going on over here, which is the thing we say we're filming, but we're really just trying to do this thing where we get trapped with a snake. Like,
They cut back to I don't know. I don't know why I'm precious about giving stuff away that's just best ofs. That's but funny. If you the stuff after that snake bit specifically, because that was a prank within a prank, and then there's one more joke.
Oh, that's funny.
There's one more joke right after that. And bits like that where it's just sort of like, I'm so done, then something else hits you and you're like, God damn it.
I love this. I deeply want to experience this.
Yeah, if you do, that would be such a fascinating. Yeah, obviously this is not for anyone else in your household.
Feels like it would be a waste to watch by myself. You know, I want to experience this with a group of people.
I will say the 0.5s are totally worth it too. So for each movie, they have the stuff that didn't make it, which is in some cases as good as, especially with, like, I think 3.5 and 4.5. Just as interesting. So, like, don't miss those too if you go through those. But yeah, the only thing with like 4 and 5 onward, they brought on new people so they could spread these out because they're old. And like, it's kind of a mixed bag. Like, I like a couple of them, but it feels like it's funny because they have one of the Mythbusters in there, but it feels like when the Mythbusters got new people and you're just sort of like, okay, well, they're not Adam and Jamie, you know, like,
I don't care about these fuckers.
Yeah.
Yeah. But still, and Paul Walter Hauser is in everything.
Yeah. Really?
Just the way it, yes. It's just in everything now. But yeah, it was a good time. Glad I got to.
Yeah. I also got to see one movie. Which I took myself out on Father's Day, and I'm like, I'm just going to the theater. And I did see The Furious. That movie fucking rules.
I can't wait to see that movie. That's awesome.
Yeah, it's it builds really well in terms of like, you know, fights getting better as the movie goes on, and like the climactic battle is like probably one of the best fight scenes. No, it is one of the best fight scenes I've seen. In a movie.
That's what I keep hearing. Yep.
So like well done. And there's like, you know, it's this 2v2 fight that turns into like, then they throw another guy into it. Who is not really on either side and is kind of against both of them, which creates this like really interesting fight dynamic that you don't like see. And it's just good. It's just like really just fantastic choreography. Go figure. You know, some familiar faces are there from The Raid. And those movies.
Yeah, that one's been on my radar for like the year, and I was glad that it got like enough of a push that like, I'm not saying it's mainstream, but like more people heard of it, you know, and got out there.
Yeah, I went to see it at like 9:30 in the morning.
Looks like it's available to stream at home as of today.
Yeah, and just to explain what it is, is a, you know, Hong Kong style martial arts movie with, you know, guy's daughter gets kidnapped by human traffickers. And he has some kind of history that isn't really ever gone into in any great detail that makes him a very bad man. And teams up with a reporter, and they go like kick the shit out of a ton of people.
So it's a classic Where's My Elephant, except the elephant is the daughter. Yes.
And the elephant is a child, and spoiler, is not a skeleton when he gets a hold of her.
Right. I did rewatch that in the last year or two. Go figure. It rules still.
Yeah. It's good, and then there's like I want to say it's like the second like big fight scene, like dude pulls out like a hammer halfway through, and then it's just like, oh shit, like for the rest of the movie, just
cool,
fucking really good. It was awesome.
Good to hear.
Not for children.
It
is extremely fucking violent. So yeah, that was great.
Fuck yeah. Glad to hear. Yeah. I feel like that'll be towards the top of my list at this point.
Absolutely.
I watched that Lorne Michaels documentary, a worthwhile watch, even though it is like almost infuriatingly obtuse.
I couldn't do it, but
he just is a terrible subject. Like it's not that he doesn't cooperate. It's just that he talks in circles. He is just an impenetrable guy, and you can really feel the filmmakers like trying to work around that. It is still surprisingly revealing in a lot of ways, and I learned a lot, and I'm glad that I watched it, but it's just hamstrung by the fact that Lorne will barely say more than two sentences at a time and will not reveal what is truly on his mind. At any moment. So that was interesting. But more than that, what I would like to share and broadcast as far and wide as I can is that I've been absolutely obsessed with a coffee table book that I found at Barnes & Noble a couple of weeks before my birthday when I was out shopping with my kids, and let them know, like, hey, guys, this is on clearance for $20 right now. This book would, this is, it, it's, It's a book about Back to the Future. It is like a big behind the scenes coffee table book about Back to the Future. Just one of these, one of the most glorious coffee table books that is just filled with pre-production sketches and production photos and like just like, you know, the book boasts that had like unprecedented access to everyone involved in the film, firsthand interviews with with Bob's Gale and Zemeckis and with and when with Chris Lloyd and Michael J. Fox and just lots of really, really great behind the scenes filmmaking stuff. And I said to my kids, like, hey, this would be a great affordable Father's Day / birthday present for dad. And so, yeah, I opened that up on either Father's Day or my birthday. I don't remember which is which. And I have not been able to put it down ever since because the like the number of tidbits. I mean, that is a trilogy of movies that has so much to give, so much to teach anyone interested in the art of filmmaking. And I have yet to watch even like I'm led to understand that the many anniversary disc releases have been filled with lots of great behind the scenes docs and stuff.
They've been great.
So, but a lot of this stuff is like there are details that are new to me, and especially hearing like stuff about like perspectives from the actors about the particular acting challenge when Chris Lloyd, like something that I as an actor can relate to is Chris Lloyd coming after it's been 4 years since they shot Back to the Future 1, and the first week on Back to the Future 2, they're shooting the scene where he has to hand like a set of pliers to himself in 1955. And and Chris Lloyd is describing the acting challenge here. It's like he's the same person, but not only is he in two completely different periods in his life that are 30 years apart, but also each of these versions of him has information that they are guarding from the other.
Yeah.
The younger version thinks he's talking to a stranger and needs to hide what he's did the you know what he's doing, and the older version knows everything and is and so he like I had to act both of those perspectives back to back, and that kind of stuff just from an actor's perspective blows my mind that even someone I respect and revere had difficulty and had to like work on that and make sure that that read to the audience and that the audience wouldn't even second guess it. And then beyond that, just like I am constantly doling out little tidbits to my family about how every practical effect was seen. Like, did you, they did it this way and they did it this way. And like my kids are genuinely amazed because they just assume they've never known a world where something was not just done by a non-union animator on a computer.
Right.
and so to hear the great lengths that they had to do just to accomplish these basic effects is they are honestly curious. Every morning, Julia asks me for more Back to the Future facts. And if for someone like me, who for whom like I have worked in the entertainment industry all my life, but largely as a performer, and I've always been interested in the other side of filmmaking, and I'm sort of becoming a very late in life student of filmmaking, this book has been an incredible textbook for me.
Awesome.
And so I'm enjoying the hell out of it. And the fact that it is only $20 on the clearance rack at every Barnes and Noble across the nation right now is kind of a steal. I can't recommend it enough. Like, it's some of the best $20 I ever asked my kids to spend on me.
No, that sounds awesome.
I assume mom bought it and never got paid back for that. Those kids are fucking skinflints. But yeah, like I've just absolutely hooked on this book every free minute I have to read, and they are not pestering me. I've been buried in it. So the big Back to the Future coffee table book at Barnes and Noble. Cool. It's awesome.
That was called.
Yeah.
No, I don't know what it's called. It might just be called Back to the Future. I don't know.
Come on, Dave.
It's like three stories up right now. It's all the way up in my bedroom. Otherwise I'd go grab it. Oh wait, actually I took a picture of it. I took
this
a photo
guy bragging about the size of his house here.
It's
well, while you're doing
that,
just
that
off
a basement.
Off of the Lorne Michaels doc, late to the party see the Questlove's 50 years of music documentary, which was incredible.
I still have not seen that. Yeah.
Yeah, if nothing else, and it was going around at the time, watch the intro, because it's a 10-minute mashup, and it's incredible, but whole thing's great. like it, they did a really good job, especially like I'm in the middle of editing two separate documentaries sort of about the same thing, and just like seeing how do you take 50 years and break it down to, you know, a palatable way under 2 hours to show all of this stuff is pretty incredible. Yeah, any Questlove doc, I think I will see day one at this point. Mm. They've all been so good. Summer Soul, Sly Live.
No, I got to put that on my watch list. So for reference, the book is called Back to the Future, The Ultimate Visual History. And in general, I'm a sucker for design documents and early costume renderings and, like, you know, seeing multiple what ifs, like this is what the DeLorean could have looked like, because they've got three different pre-production artists brainstorming ideas. And I'm such a sucker for that stuff to begin with. And then as a bonus, the book comes with all these little like paper reproductions of paper props from the film. Like, it comes with an envelope that you can open up and unfold and read Marty's warning to Doc to wear a bulletproof vest. And it comes with, like, like Lorraine and George's prom photo together from the end of the sea dance. Just little
kitschy,
nice little touches like that. The book is like every few pages, there's some little goodie glued to the page for you. The Ultimate Visual History, that's what it's called. $20.
Love it.
Love it. Yeah.
Love it.
All right, cool.
Yeah, I think that's all I have.
The only thing I'm going to mention real quick is I did have the opportunity to actually watch a TV show.
There we go.
Because the child was out at the grandparents for a couple nights. And it's like I dropped him off and came back, and then Lauren and I promptly fell asleep, and then got up, got ice cream, and then came back home and pretty much fell asleep again. But then the next day we were like, oh, we could just watch something. We can watch whatever without the child. And then found out that Game of Thrones show, A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms, is six like sub 40-minute episodes.
Yeah.
We were like, we can binge a show really easy.
Did you like?
It was great.
I heard it was really good.
Yeah, all the reasons that, you know, Dave kind of talked about, and that it's low stakes, separated from, you know, the grander Game of Thrones, stuff. Focuses on a much smaller story. You know, those, you know, familiar families and politics do come into play, but, you know, it's not like overwhelming, and it's great and goofy, but still, you know, serious and has heart to it. So and the fact that, again, it's like 3.5 hours of your time to watch that thing front to back, that's fantastic.
Big affection for that show,
so that's great. More stuff like that, just like in general, you know, in media. Ooh. Just like one-off stories that are not shows that don't have to drag on for seasons and seasons and cliffhangers upon cliffhangers and whatever, and just like it's still part of a franchise. They just told a story and got done with it and got out.
We're not in that era I feel like anymore. Like we're inching towards the British one series or two, you know, six episodes.
Let's do another one.
Let's do another one.
Just make it as long as it needs to be. And that's all. All right. That's cool. It.
Good stuff.
It's going to do it. Yep.
All right.
Hey, everybody. Cool. This has been the Fat Gatsby podcast. I've been Dave. Sure, that's Weiss. That's Tim. Come join us again.
I'm
next time we do this. Sometime
next month.
Midsummer. Yeah. In a month from now, we're doing a good job keeping to our schedule. We did mere holiday delay this weekend. Really? We
took. Oh, what month is this? What month is this episode? Is this July or is this June?
This is I
don't know.
This has got to be. This is the. I don't know. I don't know what we do.
Yeah, because we're still
it's usually past the first.
No. Well, I just say we've missed one this year. I know we have.
Yeah.
So, but I think so we're not on schedule at all.
It could be July. There's no reason.
Sometimes it's like end of the month. Sometimes it's the beginning of the month.
Well, agree to disagree.
I think we just missed. I think we just missed April, and I think that's all it is. And I think this is July, and that's that.
All right. Will we be here in August? We'll see.
I think so. I feel pretty confident. It's a long month.
That's what everyone says.
We're gonna get it in towards the beginning. It's gonna be early because the last week is fraught. So yeah.
Oh yeah.
All right. Boy. Thanks for listening. Yep. Catch us later.
Goodbye, everybody. Bye. And cut.